All right, everyone, I'd like to start off with some thanks to a whole bunch of people. First off, to all the teachers that we've had around this weekend. We've had a few new people who have never taught at the weekend study before, and they did a great job, and we had some veterans, and so far I've been super encouraged by this weekend. If you haven't yet, find one of the teachers after we're done with this entire thing. Thank them for the research, the effort, and everything that went into preparing their lessons. And also, I want to be thankful to all of you that are here. This is our 8th year doing the weekend study here at Auburn. And some of you have been here for all 8 of those years. Started off with a bunch of epistles, moved on to some topical stuff in the middle. Now we're returning to text again. And it's been so encouraging every year to see more and more people show up. Started off back in the classroom, ran out of room, had to come in here. And still, we constantly have new faces and some old faces, too, that we get to see and be encouraged every year. And we're all so thankful for the people that come and visit with us at Auburn. And it's so good to be able to see people every year. If you want, go ahead and open up to Ruth chapter 4. We're going to be finishing up the end of the book during this last class. And really, we only have 10 verses to cover. And there's nothing new in these verses that the other teachers haven't already alluded to. So there's no new narration, no new story, nothing that's going to blow your mind during these last 10 verses. But I believe that they're still very helpful to kind of dive into. These last 10 verses answer a question. It answers the question about why this book was written. So far, we've dived into some wonderfully helpful application about character study, about topics of relationships, topics about providence and trusting in the Lord. And these last 10 verses cover all those things, but it answers, why did this author write this book? What is it supposed to mean to the ancient Jews? What is it supposed to mean to us as modern Christians, as people trying to follow God now? These last 10 verses, they don't stand alone, but they work to help identify what the cause of this book is. To introduce these last 10 verses, I want us to think back and run a quick review over everything else that has happened in the book of Ruth. And we're going to see how these last 10 verses take this story from a story about people and it elevates it to a story about the divine. Okay? So far, if you think back to the beginning, the book of Ruth has kind of been a princess story. All right? It hasn't varied much from our typical fairy story, if you will, of how we would expect this to go. We have this young lady who finds herself right after she's introduced in these terrible, dire straits. And she is down in the worst situation in her life, and yet she sticks to her guns, right? She's still hopeful. She still perseveres. She's still pure. She holds true to all those things that we hold to be good virtues in people. And so our young princess is still pressing on through all the hardship, and she meets this rich young bachelor who has the opportunity to make her a princess and to get her out of her life of despair and bring her into a life of hope, to save her, to redeem her, offer her that salvation. And then they face this one last big obstacle where they should lose. And in Ruth, it's that other relative who has the legal power, and he should be the one to redeem her, but instead they overcome even that. And now we get to see this grand celebration at the end. We get to see this victory, all right, this triumph, if you will, of love. Maybe romantic love in this situation, maybe redeeming love. And we get to see this kind of final victory that's proclaimed for us. Now, all of that has gone according to what we'd expect. That's the Disney formula. That's the way Cinderella goes all the way through. And here at the end, we'd expect a very similar ending, right? We get a quick wedding montage where we have a few, you know, glimpses of the bride and the groom dancing around, and then all the cast sings a song that we knew from earlier in the movie, and we get little cuts of, you know, comedic characters that we knew along the way, and that's how we finish out the story. We finish out the story with a reminder of the people. We get a story of characters and what they did to earn this great love that they achieve at the end. And the book of Ruth ends on that happy of a note. It ends with that sort of grand romantic and redeeming love at the end. But instead of focusing on any of the characters, these last 10 verses kind of take a turn. It kind of takes a turn and drops off a lot of the characters that we've talked about so far and focuses in on just one, the true main character of the book of Ruth, which is, of course, God. And it does that in two main ways. First, it helps us to identify the true hero of this story, which is God's faithfulness. I'm sorry, I'm a slow writer. And secondly, it helps us identify the true goal of the story, which is God's plan. These last 10 verses highlight these two themes probably more strongly than anything else in the book. And to begin with, we're going to talk about God's faithfulness. So if you will, I'm going to have people among you to read. Make sure you read super loud because there's a lot of people here. If somebody will jump in and read Ruth chapter 4, verses 13 through 15 for me. All right, thank you. So we have verse 13 that mentions the actual end of the narrative, right? Ruth and Boaz, they get married, she becomes his wife, they have a kid, everything is going to be okay. This is the only time that she's directly mentioned in these last 10 verses. From here on, even though the book's named after her, we don't really get to hear about her again because now we're changing gears. Now we're focusing on God. Verse 14 starts this story of the women to Naomi. Now, depending on your translation, some of yours might even say the women sang to Naomi. From my understanding is that this might not have just been a thing that they had, you know, like everyone was coming up and, you know, giving her a pat on the back and saying, like, hey, good job on the grandkid. But instead, it may have been something they were all together and singing as a united group of friends unto Naomi. And so they're encouraging her in these three main things that I think we can pull from this about God's faithfulness. The first one is glaringly obvious. It starts off in verse 14. Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day. These are fantastic friends. Let's review the story of Naomi for a bit, all right? She started off, hopefully, you know, in a good situation. We imagine so because she seemed to know a lot about the Lord. Went off, all of her family died, comes back, and she is, you know, in constant worry about starving to death. And she changes her name to Bitterness because of how down she is about life. She contains no hope whatsoever. And these women, these friends of hers, step in and they say, Naomi, God was with you all along. Now, I don't imagine that they only started talking to Naomi at the end of the story. I imagine that these friends were encouraging her all along. That might be part of why she had such great plans for Ruth. That might have been part about why she was so encouraging to Ruth and to Boaz, because she had these friends who helped remind her of God's faithfulness even in the roughest of times. Naomi was a bitter woman at the beginning, but by the end, she also recognizes that the Lord has been with her all along, and the Lord's faithfulness is there with her. Now, let's make some quick application. Sometimes we're really bitter people. Sometimes we find ourselves and we feel ill-treated, we feel forsaken, and we feel forgotten by people around us and by God. And we feel like our entire situation is bad. And that is something that can destroy our faith so quickly. What makes it worse is when we're surrounded by friends who can also only focus on the bitter things in life. Friends who can only nag about how things ran during church services. Friends who only are disappointed whenever they hear that this certain preacher is going to be on that Sunday. Friends who don't focus on the good things in life with you, but instead are critical of everything else everyone does. When we surround ourselves with friends like that, that is a fast track to destroying our faith, because it's a fast track to focusing on everything but the Lord's faithfulness. With this, we need to keep in mind, we need to be the type of friends that can change our group. If our groups are filled with people who are bitter, I'm not saying you should ditch all of your friends and go off and become friends with somebody who's happy and optimistic by life. If that's what it takes, do that, but change your group. Be the person who starts saying, no, we are not going to complain about others all the time. We are not going to focus on all the bad things in life, but instead we're going to be speaking about the joy of the Lord to one another. That's what these women were doing for Ruth, for Naomi. That's what got Naomi through. It transformed her from bitterness in the beginning into a woman who has hope and recognizes that the Lord has not left her, but instead the Lord has been with her. Point your friends towards God's faithfulness and have friends that point you towards the Lord. Second way that we see God's faithfulness during these short few verses is going to be at the beginning of verse 15. It says, he shall be a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. Now, I'm going to make this comment just because it's in the text. We do need to be especially mindful oftentimes of older Christians, because they're the ones who oftentimes are kind of forgotten. they get to a point where maybe they can't attend services as much, they can't lead as much, they can't be around as much or get to people and talk to them, and they can be forgotten. I don't think most of us can probably personally empathize with that, but it's a situation we don't need to forget about. But also what we don't need to forget is that it's not just the old people that need a restorer of life. It's not just the old people who need a physician to come and heal their broken hearts. It's the young people as well. Ruth also needed to be saved in this story. She also was destroyed and needed someone to come in and save her life. And that's exactly what God did. We're going to get to some more application on the faithfulness of the Lord as we get close to the end of the lesson. But I want us to take a moment just to look at two promises in two separate Psalms. And again, I'll get you guys to read for me, focusing on the Lord's restorative powers. If somebody can read Psalm chapter 147, verses 1 through 3 for me. And then another person, if you can turn to Psalm 34 and read 17 through 19 for me. Very similar, but slightly different. Who's got Psalm 147 for me? Hands up. All right, Sean, you'll get that. Who's got Psalm 34 for me? Okay, so Sean, and then if you could both read loudly. Go ahead. 1 through 3.
Praise the Lord, for it is good to sing praises to our God, for it is pleasant and praise is beautiful. The Lord builds up Jerusalem. He gathers together the outcasts of Israel. He heals the brokenhearted and binds up their wounds.
Okay, go ahead. I love the way both of those start. They start with ideas of praise. They start with ideas about how the Lord deserves your attention because he comes to the brokenhearted. He comes to those who are afflicted. That doesn't matter if you're old or you're young, because sometimes we're young and that's when we feel broken in life. Even in those times, that's when the Lord will come to us. That's when the Lord will be faithful for us, and he will help us through those times. Again, we're going to return to this idea later, but keep these Psalms in mind. Keep these promises in mind because we're going to return to them. And then the third way in which we see the faithfulness of the Lord during this short little exposition from the women into Naomi is near the very end of verse 15, actually right after what we just read. They're saying the Lord is faithful, he has not forgot you. And the way that they describe that this happened in her life is they say, for your daughter-in-law who loves you and is more to you than seven sons has given birth to a son. How did Naomi know that the Lord was faithful? Because she had Ruth. Because Ruth loved her. The love of the people around us is the faithfulness of God being shown in our lives. Okay? So when you think about the friends that love you and encourage you, that's God's faithfulness being planted in your life. When you think about your parents, your family members who have cared for you so long, when you think about your elders and your preachers who care about getting a certain message to you and they want you there at church, people who want to be around you to help lift you up in various ways, that is God's faithfulness. It's not simply the act of just that individual. That is the faithfulness of the Lord working in your life. Now, that's a weird concept together, but it gives us two big applications from this. When you have people around you that love you, and I imagine that all of us do who are here today, when you have people around you that love you, don't just view them as people. Don't just view them as people who are doing a good thing for whatever reason that they want to do it. View it as an extension of the faithfulness of God, because that's what it is. It is the Lord himself showing you that he loves you and that he cares about you. And secondly, become an extension of God's faithfulness. Those around you who are your friends, those around you who you care about, you're not just caring about them because they're fun to be around, because we have similar hobbies, because of all those whatever menial, small things. Instead, we care about them because God's faithfulness is supposed to be extended into their lives. That will make a big difference in how we view people. And it'll make a big difference in how we react when our friends care about us and how we're going to care about our own friends. That's the faithfulness of God. Naomi realized this by the end. Ruth realized this by the end. And we too can learn that from the book of Ruth. That's what I believe the author was trying to get across, is the idea that God's faithfulness is the true hero here. And you notice, Ruth was a very faithful person. She was faithful to Naomi. She was faithful unto God. And she was faithful in all sorts of ways. And yet her faithfulness didn't save her at all. Instead, it was the faithfulness of God that brought her through into redemption. Now, let's change gears and let's focus on the plan of God. If somebody can go back to Ruth chapter 4 for me and read verses 16 through 22. Who wants to hit that? Ruth 4, 16 through 22. All right. Throughout this story, we've seen a lot of plans come into action. Okay? That's been most of what we've talked about, the plans of people, some of which have succeeded and some of which have failed. I mean, we saw Elimelech's plan, which got his family killed. And then we see Naomi's plan, which ends up in their redemption. We see Boaz's plan for redemption, which hit a speed bump in the middle of the road, thought it was going to stop him, but instead it carried through. We've seen all sorts of plans come and go throughout the story. People succeeding, people failing, some people dying, some people living because of the plans, and yet none of those are the true goal of the book of Ruth. Instead, we get to see here at the end that the real plan all along was to bring about David. The real plan all along was to move the focus from being in the present and instead to the future. Now, we've had several of our teachers already bring up the concept of David and what he means in this story. But what we get to see here is truly that this story isn't just about the deliverance of Ruth. It's about the deliverance of God's people. Because David is going to become a king, of course, who is a man after God's own heart, the best king that Israel ever has. He's going to start a dynasty that's going to last about 500 years, starting with himself. That is going to be the only reason that the southern kingdom of Judah hangs around as long as it does. They have times of righteousness, and they have times of sorrow, really. But that's what gets them through, largely because of David, because of him. And that is God's plan all through the book of Ruth. His plan is to offer his people some form of deliverance, some form of salvation through David. And here's a big point, okay? If you don't listen to the rest of my lesson, listen to this sentence, because this is going to be the main thing. God's plan is always working towards this one purpose, the salvation of his people. That's what we see on a small scale with Ruth. That's what we see with big scale with David and Israel. And that's what we're going to see a little bit later on in the bigger scale leading all the way to Christ. God's plan is always working towards the one thing, the salvation of his people. That is why this book is recorded. It's to show us that his plans all along have been working towards that one goal. So let's do a bit of summary of these last 10 verses of the book of Ruth, and then we're going to jump to the New Testament, and we're going to do application for like the rest of my time, okay? And so, like I said, there wasn't much to cover here, but we're going to spend a lot of time in the New Testament. First thing we've learned, Ruth's faithfulness, her merit and everything she had, it didn't earn her anything. Instead, it was God's faithfulness that actually got her somewhere in life. It was God's faithfulness that redeemed her. Naomi, Boaz, Ruth's plans, all those things may have failed, may have worked, doesn't matter. It was God's plan that worked towards the salvation of his people. It was God's plan that brought them through the other side. And then lastly, and this is a combination of the two things, Ruth did a lot of work. Ruth did a lot of great things throughout her life. A lot of these characters did. But in all of it, they can't boast in their own works. They can't say any of those things that they did are what saved them. Instead, they can only boast in the works of God. This is what we're going to focus on for the application. This is what we're supposed to get from the book of Ruth. No matter how hard our life is, no matter how good our life becomes, all we can boast in is the works of God. The amazing thing is that you don't only have to learn this from the book of Ruth. You can see this in your own life. You should see this in your own life. These are applications that you don't have to learn abstractly and through others. These are applications you can see day to day, and you can see in your own changes as you go through the years, that you can, in essence, be like Ruth. We thought she was the main character, and we learned that truly God is the main character who got things done. Put yourself in the place of Ruth, just as we've talked about in every lesson. You're not the main character. God can become the main character of your life, and you can see his faithfulness and his plan working through your own story. Let's begin to talk about this. If you guys will, go ahead and turn over to Luke chapter 3. Luke chapter 3. Let's talk about God's plan again, except this time we're talking about it working in our lives instead of just in Ruth's life. Now, somebody here is going to have a really fun reading. If you can read Luke chapter 3, verses 23 through 32 for me. A lot of names. Who wants to hit that up? Go ahead. All right. Thank you, ma'am. You went a bit further than I expected, but that's okay. That still helps the point that I'm trying to make here. Why did Luke write that? Why did we just read that? What is that supposed to mean to us? It means a lot of things. We just talked about how the book of Ruth and the little genealogy at the end of that, much shorter genealogy, was about God providing a king of salvation for his people. And really, this entire thing exists because it's showing us that God provides our king of salvation to his new people. As the book of Ruth works towards the greatest king that Israel ever had, it works to the greatest king that the earth will ever have. But there's a bit more than this in this entire genealogy. It's not just a history. It's not just like, hey, here's an historical account, so if you want to go back and, like, you know, fact check me, here's the list of all the names of people that are going on. This means more than that. This is supposed to teach us more about God's plan than just the fact that there are a bunch of people in it. It teaches us about how God's plan lasted through all the hard times. It lasted through all the times where it looked like it was about to fail. And it lasted through all the times that people were really down in their life and in the toughest situations. God's plan still pushed through, and it still brought about the salvation of his people. We can look back at some of the names that we just went through. Zerubbabel, who was the one that led the Jews out of captivity, a situation in which they were abandoned from their homeland, and everything looked really bad. How on earth, you know, the lineage of David seemed lost. How on earth was God going to bring about the Messiah anymore? And Zerubbabel was the one to lead the people back, and he saved them in that. Joash, who survived through his grandmother's murder spree when it looked like the line of David was about to be extinguished and God's promises were no longer going to last anymore. Joash survived through that in a miraculous way. Ruth, when she went through this time of extreme poverty and looked like she was going to starve, still, God's plan proved true. God's plan won through the hard hours. Abram, when he was wandering around in the desert forever and he couldn't have a kid, yet God's plan still rang true. We have Noah when he's surrounded by sin and a flood is destroying all the earth, yet he survives for God's plan. And we have Adam. We have Adam who was in the garden and was cast out because of sin. Yet even there, God's plan is going to ring true. God's plan is going to succeed, and it's going to bring about the salvation of his people. That's why I didn't mind you reading all the way through, because getting back to Adam shows us that it's been from the very beginning that no matter the hard times, God's plan has succeeded through. Now to us, that means something, because we're not just looking at a historical account here of, okay, when was humanity bad and God still won through? We're looking at our own lives. When is your life bad? Is your life bad right now? It might be. Some people here are surely in a situation where they feel pretty low, in a situation where they feel it's pretty dark, and they're not sure whether or not they're going to get through on the other side with the sort of love of God in their hearts. God's plan is still going to win. God's plan still rings true through every dark time. Through every struggle, his plan will still succeed, and his plan stays the same. It's working towards the salvation of his people. More than that, we can even say those times of struggle that we face are the opportunities for God's plan to shine even brighter. Let's go ahead and jump over to Romans chapter 5. I know Reagan alluded to this last night, or actually we read it, but we're going to reread some of those same verses. Romans chapter 5. Who wants to loudly read verses 3 through 5 for me? Okay, so we go through tribulations, and it leads to all these steps in character building, and it ends up with us having this sort of hope. And what does that hope do for us? What does the text say about hope? Okay, does not disappoint, that's one translation. Any others? Does not put us to shame. I really like that one. No offense to the disappointed people. But, like, does not put to shame, I think, is great. Because when we go through tribulations, sometimes we fail. And it doesn't matter if we fail. Normally when we feel like we're struggling with something, what we feel is shame. What we feel is like, this shouldn't happen. You know, this should be, we shouldn't have this problem, or perhaps I should be past this already. And we feel shame in those situations. But what we see is that those tribulations are made to bring us to a point past shame. It's made to bring us to a point past where we're focused on our own, whether or not we feel like we should be doing this thing. Because the only reason we have shame in ourselves is we think we should be boasting in ourselves. But instead we learn that no, we don't have shame because we're not boasting in ourselves. And instead we're now boasting in God. I wrote 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26 through 31 up here. Let's turn over there. This is what I want you to remember as the main New Testament passage for us talking about the plan of God working in your life. Because sometimes this plan of God that brings you through rough situations and is supposed to lead you out without shame seems super confusing. Sometimes we don't understand it. Sometimes we might not even think it's there because we can't understand where on earth this could be leading that somehow ends in hope. But 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26 through 31 talks us through this. I'll read this one. For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And because of him, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that as it is written, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord. We don't always understand where it's going. I am sure that Ruth didn't know that she was going to end up in a situation where she was saved. But that's our end too. Our end is the same. If we are God's people, his plan will not fail to bring his redeeming love to us. No matter how bad the times look, the Lord's plan will succeed. And the Lord's plan will push through. Now my translation says, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord. Some of you might have a different word, and it'll say, glory in the Lord. That's the reason why I chose the title of this lesson. Because we go from times of hopelessness into times of glory when we step back from being the main character and instead the Lord becomes the main character in our life. Let's move on now and talk about a little bit of application for this point. What if you cannot see the plans of God working in your life? What are you going to do? How are you going to fix this problem? First off, you need to change where your boasting is, okay? You need to change whether or not you're commending yourself for a lot of the good things and the bad things that have happened, or whether or not you recognize the plan of the Lord in your life. Now, this happens in two main ways. First off is verbally. And I know sometimes we get really annoyed at those people who, no matter what happens, you know, you come up to them and you're like, hey, you know, good job on singing you did, and they're just like, praise God. And it seems kind of annoying, right? Because why won't they just accept the compliment? Why won't they just recognize that I'm trying to talk to them? It's because they're not the main character of their life anymore. It's because now they're putting those things onto the Lord. So first off, I say change your boasting verbally. More importantly, though, is change your boasting mentally. Because we can get in a state where we say, yep, praise God for that good thing that happened, and that doesn't mean we're registering it up here. We have to change our boasting, both out loud and in our own mind, and that'll give us a new perspective on who should receive the glory in different times. And the second point I want to make for how we can start to see the plan of God in our life more is to dwell on his faithfulness. So that's going to be our last topic as we jump into the New Testament, God's faithfulness. Let's go ahead and turn back to Romans chapter 5. We're going to be there in a moment. God's faithfulness, returning to this idea again. It's amazing how many problems in life, specifically spiritual problems, are solved by the building of faith. I generally ascribe to the theory that all of our problems spiritually come from a lack of faith. It doesn't matter whether that's something with relationships, something personal, if it comes to pride, if it comes down to problems with others, it doesn't matter. Normally you can look back at all of it and ascribe it to a problem of faith, normally not believing in the promises of God. All of these things can come back to faith. And so it's super important for us to meditate on God's faithfulness. Because if we recognize him as being the most faithful being, then we're going to recognize that we can, in fact, put our faith in him. Now, three ways that we do this, we've already covered. We're going to do it like Naomi did back in Ruth chapter 4. Okay? Remember the three things I talked about? First, we're going to surround ourselves with friends who focus on the faithfulness of God. Whether that means we have to make the friend group or find the friend group, we're going to surround ourselves with people who focus on the joys of the Lord. People who are optimistic, people who look forward to that heavenly glory someday and have their eyes trained ahead. People who have that sort of insight on life, that sort of focus in life, are the sort of people we want to surround ourselves with. And that means when we're down, they help us. That means when we can't see the finish line, they're going to be the ones pointing us onward and guiding our way. And that also means that when they're in situations where they're down, we need to be willing to step up and be those sort of friends that help point them onward and say, the Lord has not left you. The Lord has not left you without a redeemer. Fight on. Second, focus on the promises of God. This is why I had us read those two Psalms earlier. I had us read those because we need to understand that the Lord promises to be with the brokenhearted. The Lord promises to be with those who are struggling. The Lord promises to be with his people. Now, generally we have a few promises of the Lord that we recognize, and they're all future-based, and that's fine. It's fine. In fact, that's what our faith is pushed forward to. But we need to make a study of all the promises of God. Because I guarantee that if you start looking through all the promises that the Lord has made to you, you're going to start recognizing where those are fulfilled in your life. You're going to start recognizing where the Lord is actually working in your life, and where he's bringing you through just like he said he would, and where he's being faithful just like his character describes him to be. We're going to recognize more promises of God in our life the more time that we spend studying them. That's why I pointed out those two Psalms earlier, and we can't go through a ton of promises right now, but that's something that I think would be very helpful to all of us. And as we see more promises fulfilled, our faith becomes stronger, and we can start placing even more and more hope and more of our life into those promises we haven't seen yet, because we know that the Lord is faithful, because we will see them fulfilled one day. And then lastly, the third point, it's a repeat from earlier. Look at the love that God has already given you. Look at, a lot of you come from strong spiritual families. Look at that love that has been given to you through your family. That is the faithfulness of God in your life. Look at the love that has been given to you through your friends. My friends have helped me through a lot of discouraging times, especially since I got to college. And that is the faithfulness of the Lord, where he said, he will not leave me when I'm brokenhearted and I'm down. Look at the love that your fellow church members have for you. Look at the love, as I said, your elders, your deacons, and for all the people who maybe have more wisdom than you, maybe even less, but people who love you, that is the faithfulness of God being pushed into your life. And then, of course, with the same idea in mind of understanding the faithfulness of God from the love of others, we can understand the faithfulness of God from the love of God. In Romans chapter 5, I told you guys to turn to it, and I didn't do it. If one of you will read verses 6 through 8, picking up where we left off. Who wants to get that? Go ahead. Even when you were hopeless and you were worthless, much like Ruth was during most of her story, that is when God extended his faithfulness to you in the strongest way possible, through the death of his son. It's not necessarily based on our merit, just like it wasn't with Ruth. It's not based on all of our faithfulness in our life. It's the Lord's faithfulness. And we can see that fulfilled in so many ways as we discuss, but specifically in the death of his son. How can we know that God is faithful? We can know that he's faithful because of the cross. Because the cross exists, because the cross was where Jesus died for us, we know that God is faithful because he wanted us, because he bought us and he redeemed us even when we were worthless to him. Let's jump over to Galatians chapter 6 now. And if you remember one specific passage, about the faithfulness of the Lord in the New Testament, this is where I want us to focus. And from this, we're not going to jump into all the context of Galatians, but understand that it's mostly about fighting within a congregation between a circumcision party and the Gentiles, and these people arguing different ways of what will earn them into heaven. And in chapter 6, verses 12 through 15 is where we're going to read. It is those who want to make a good showing in the flesh who would have you forced to be circumcised, and only in order that they may not be persecuted for the cross of Christ. For even those who are circumcised do not themselves keep the law, but they desire to have you circumcised that they may boast in your flesh. But far be it from me to boast, except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by which the world has been crucified to me, and I to the world. For neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision, but a new creation. We can't boast in anything we do. We can't boast in our own faithfulness and how good we are at keeping laws. We can't boast in any of our own merits. We can boast only in the cross. We can boast only in God's faithfulness. This is what we're supposed to learn from the book of Ruth. And it doesn't just apply to the old ancient Jews. It applies to us today. God's plan is our ultimate goal. God's faithfulness is our ultimate hero. And that's all that we can glory in. That's all that we can boast in our lives. With that in mind, understand that that's not a depressing thought. Sometimes at first that might seem a little weird, because I hate the idea of having to forget myself. I hate the idea of having to give up some personal ambitions, give up some personal responsibility. I hate the idea of a whole lot of those things to only glory in God. But what we need to understand is that this is the greatest glory possible. This is the greatest thing we can ever boast in. And this is where the most joy and the most hope in everything in our lives will come from. Let that rule your life. Keep that ever in front of you. Keep the faithfulness and the plan of God constantly on your mind. That's what's going to get you through the hard times. That's what's going to get you through the good times too. Because in all those situations, there's the risk of pride. But we can only boast in God. And all of our glory will only be found in him. I'm going to work down to a conclusion now by returning to what I started the study with and what Reagan and others have also used during their lesson, a return to names. I've been really surprised that I don't think any of the teachers have talked specifically about the name of Ruth. I think most of us know what Ruth means. It means mercy. She's a person who is identified by and completely created by the mercy of God. Now, I doubt that she changed her name to fit the function of this story, but that would be a fitting thing to do. She was a person who was completely controlled and created by the mercy of God, both in his plan working to bring her to success and then also in his faithfulness and never leaving her. We have to be those same sort of people. Now, I'm not necessarily suggesting that you go out and you change your name to Mercy or something else that reminds you of God's faithfulness. Unless that's what's really going to help you, then by all means, go out and do it. I don't know how much it costs to, like, change your name legally, but, I mean, it'd be worth it. It'd be worth it if that's what keeps the faithfulness and the plan of the Lord ever before our eyes. So as we leave here this weekend, as we go out after this, let's be Ruths. Let's be Ruths. People who are known for and people who always keep the mercy of the Lord in front of them. That's our greatest glory. That's the greatest thing we can ever hope to boast for in this life or the next. Let's end with a prayer, and then we're going to have Douglas lead us in one last song, after which we're going to have a closing prayer.